School districts across the country are only a few weeks away from their tentative school year, but COVID-19 has left them grappling with how or if they can reopen safely.
The question of whether to reopen schools and when to do it depends a lot on the level of transmission within the communities.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, July 21st, we hear from teachers who are struggling with whether or not to return to the classroom in a few weeks.
I don't want our students, as well as my children, to be part of an experiment to see if it's possibly okay for them to go. It almost feels like the weight of the economy is on our shoulders right now, so it's a very hard and difficult place to be in.
Plus, how are you feeling about your kid going back to school? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. And then we round out the show with more on the legacy of John Lewis. You know his amazing voice, but he was also the co-author of a graphic novel.
When I was about 17 and a half, almost 18, I guess, I read a comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story that told the story of the Montgomery bus boycott. And this little comic book inspired me and many other young people to get involved in the civil rights movement.
With the 2020 school year set to begin in just a couple of weeks, the Trump administration is pushing to fully reopen schools for in-person learning and is threatening to withhold money from districts that won't reopen in the fall. But the heated debate over how and whether to reopen schools is really being fought at the state level. In California, where there are nearly 390,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, Governor Gavin Newsom announced new rules on Friday that would require most schools to teach remotely this fall.
Learning remains non-negotiable, but neither is the safety of all of our cohorts of support staff as well as our children.
In Florida, which has become an epicenter of the pandemic, Governor Ron DeSantis had this to say over the weekend about reopening schools in his state.
The science on that is just overwhelming. Yes, they're at almost zero risk, but even more than that, transmission from an elementary school to an adult is extremely rare.
We'll talk about the science of transmission from kids to adults in just a moment. But since those remarks, the Florida Teachers Union announced it would sue the DeSantis administration for pushing to fully reopen schools by the end of August. And we've been hearing from teachers across the country about how they're feeling about returning to the classroom.
This is Craig from Dunedin, Florida. I am a high school teacher. I have two children of my own in elementary school, and I'm also a law student at night. My main concern with the public school system is that the plan, as I like to call it, is business as usual with masks. We won't be having social distancing. We can't. There's not enough space.
This is Jill from Conover, North Carolina. I am a public school teacher, and I teach elementary technology for kindergarten through fifth grade students. I'm willing to return to work with face-to-face teaching only if the state and local COVID infection rate is at or below the level when remote construction was implemented. I feel like going back right now is just foolish.
We'll keep hearing from teachers and school staff this week, and in a little bit, we'll hear from two teachers about their stories. And you, of course, can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. But first, I spoke with Apoorva Mandavili, a science reporter from The New York Times who covers school reopenings, about just how schools across the country are planning to tackle this right now.
The question of whether to reopen schools and when to do it depends a lot on the level of transmission within the communities. And so the regions that are seeing an uptick in cases, for example, in California, are definitely making some decisions to step back on the idea of reopening schools in person and really just thinking about remote learning. But it's really kind of a patchwork at the moment, because even in Florida, for example, where the state as a whole is really struggling to contain the outbreak, Broward County is thinking about remote learning, but many other counties are not. So it almost seems like a decision that's being left up to individual school districts rather than very well thought out policy for an entire state or for an entire region.
here in New York, and I can only speak for New York because we're still getting daily briefings from Governor Cuomo, there's really been a back and forth between Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Cuomo about when and how to proceed with opening the schools. No surprise that the two of these gentlemen have often not gotten along. But at the end of the day, it was really Governor Cuomo who said that he had the final word. Are we seeing governors issuing, based on what you just told us? I mean, are there governors really starting to take control of the situation, or most folks not as like Governor Cuomo, I should say?
I think some governors are trying to take control. I think Governor of Florida did try to take control, but within the state, there are still school districts that are saying, you know what, I don't think we're ready to go back to school. And the same with, you know, California. Governor Newsom came out and said on Friday they wouldn't be opening schools wholesale, but I think individual districts will have to still make that decision, and they have a sort of watch list system to see how the districts are doing and communities are doing in terms of containing the outbreak. I think in New York, most of the state is doing very well, and we've been hovering around a 2% positivity rate, the sort of percent of cases that test positive. And that's a pretty good sign. And I think it would be okay to open schools here, as long as, of course, we take all of the precautions, the social distancing, the masks, the hand hygiene. And I think a lot of schools are thinking about opening schools for just part of the week, 2 or 3 days a week, and then doing remote. There are all kinds of combinations being considered.
You recently wrote a piece in the New York Times, Apoorva, where you talked to a panel of scientists who recommended that young students should go back to school. What are some of the benefits to opening schools in the fall for in-person classes?
I think for young kids and for kids who have disabilities, online learning is just not a feasible option in the long term. They just don't learn very well. And they don't have the attention that it takes to sit still for that many hours without a teacher guiding them. It's a huge burden on the working parents. And there's been already some reports that they are falling behind. And falling behind even for a few months at these young ages can have lifetime consequences in terms of their employment, their learning overall. And so I think the panel thought about all of those things. And very importantly, they also considered the risks to the young kids themselves and concluded that in the case of kids who are elementary school age, the benefits of going to school in person outweigh the risks.
Now, those are benefits for the students, but there are other people involved in this equation, namely the teachers and other folks who work in schools, the cleaning staff, the maintenance staff, the school cafeteria staff, the administrative workers, and of course, the parents who are sending their kids to school. Those are the folks that are very concerned, for the most part, about getting and contracting COVID-19 or the coronavirus. Tell us what happens there. I mean, you've spoken to teachers.
Teachers are rightfully extremely nervous. I think some a third of the teachers, full-time teachers in the country, are older than 50, and about a third of school principals are over 55, and those are groups that are at very high risk of severe outcomes from being infected with the coronavirus. And more than half of these teachers and administrators have said in surveys that they are very nervous about going back to school. And of course, as you said, just because the kids themselves don't get sick doesn't really mean that they won't bring the infection back home to parents or grandparents and keep the chain of transmission going in the community. So that's why it's so important to not just think about schools opening in a vacuum, but to think about what else is happening in the community. If a particular community has done a very good job of keeping the virus in check and it's doing a good amount of testing and a good amount of contact tracing and there's enough PPE available for teachers and other staff, then sure, the risks will be minimal. But without all of that kind of planning and without being able to say, for example, that the schools will be able to provide hand hygiene, they'll be able to provide masks, they'll be able to make sure that the kids stay some distance from each other during recess or lunch, it's a really big gamble.
Couple things I want to address there, because I mean, any of us who have been around young children, particularly elementary school children, know they are full of energy. And while, yes, they can take direction, I think this type of direction is going to be a challenge to wear masks and keep social distance. I mean, how are schools going to ensure that?
Yeah, that's a big question. And if you do need to enforce these things, if you do need people to remind kids that they need to do these things, and you need enough staff to make sure that you have enough staff for kids, if you're separating them and keeping them at a distance, you're going to need a lot more teachers than you have now. And already with many teachers saying they may not come back to school because they're afraid, I'm not really sure how the staffing situation is going to work.
I'm also wondering about liability. We've got to be honest about this. I mean, the risk is not zero. And yes, to your point that there are cities and states, among them New York right now, that have managed to flatten the curve, but the virus is still with us, and we're seeing peaks across the country as travel continues. We have no idea what the fall will bring. And that leads me to wonder what happens if a student or a teacher gets sick. What happens if that person dies or that student dies? I mean, these are real questions that have to be answered. Do schools have a plan for how to deal with that?
I mean, those are excellent questions, and those are exactly the questions that schools need to be asking themselves before they decide whether to open. I mean, a lot of people have been looking to foreign countries, you know, countries in Europe who have managed to open schools and not have things go really south. But those schools have also all done it very differently. You know, in Germany, once a student is infected, they sent only the classmates and teachers of that student home, but kept the rest of the schools open. In Israel, they closed the schools even after a single case. So there's no one answer to this. And this is something that schools have to think about. And they also have to think about the broader communities. One of the things that I really liked about that panel that you mentioned that I wrote about is that they said every school district has to look at everything in the community, not just the community transmission, although that's a big part of it, but how able are the kids in that community to be able to do remote learning? Is there enough good internet access? Do the kids have access to computers? Will the schools be able to provide them if they don't? And if the answers to those are no, and online learning is a no-go for a particular area, then their calculation is going to be a little bit different than, say, a part of the country where, you know, everybody has great internet access and all the kids have access to iPads and laptops.
Apoorva, one of the things that we know historically teachers in this country are often strapped for resources. We know that teachers have had to often buy their own supplies for the students that they teach. How is that going to work if teachers also have to have PPE, personal protective equipment, for themselves and for their students?
It can't. I think without funding from states and from the federal government, we're just not going to be able to have the schools be safe enough. One statistic that really struck me is that something like 50% of the school districts have schools that are in dire need of modernizing their buildings, and 40% have ventilation systems that are really outdated. So when we have schools in that shape and we don't have the resources that the school districts themselves can just suddenly modernize, we absolutely need state and federal governments to step in.
Apoorva, we've been talking so far about younger children, elementary school children, but you found some interesting data that shows that older children actually can transmit the virus similar to adults. Is that right?
That's right. There was a study that just came out from South Korea where they did some very careful contact tracing, and they concluded that kids between 10 and 19 transmit the virus just as efficiently as adults do. Now, there are some limitations to this study. We can't just take it wholesale. For example, 10 to 19 is kind of a strange grouping of age, but there is accumulating evidence that kids above 12 behave like adults for this virus, and it's not really fully clear why. It does suggest, though, that elementary school kids are probably much less likely to transmit, roughly about half as likely. That's the number that's been sort of emerging from many studies, but that it may not be as safe for middle and high school kids to go back to in-school learning.
And of course, not just the kids, but the workers in those schools. Apoorva, we've seen schools in other countries have already begun to open. Other countries have also taken precautions much more seriously, and that includes the wearing of face masks for many citizens. Is there an example where the United States can even think about catching up to at this point in terms of best practices that you've noticed across the world?
The problem there, Tanzina, is that the countries that have managed to successfully open schools are all in places that the virus is at very low levels. It's really hard to directly compare the United States to those. Having said that, there are lessons we can get from it. For example, you were mentioning earlier that it's really hard for young kids to wear masks. But in fact, many countries have actually managed to get their young kids to wear masks all day and learn how to do it. They're also doing outdoor learning. I've seen these lovely photographs of, you know, kids in Italy sitting outside at these big tables, really set apart, and the teachers are far away from them also. So anywhere where the weather cooperates, we might be able to think about having outdoor learning for kids, at least some of the time. In Germany and in Denmark and in Norway, they capped the number of students per class so that in any given class, there would only be 10 or maybe 15 kids. That's obviously very different from how most public schools in America operate. So that's something we would have to think about. And if schools close high schools, if they say high school students should learn from home, maybe all of that high school space could be used to make sure that elementary school kids are spread apart enough. So there are some things we could think about.
Apoorva Mandavili is a science reporter at the New York Times. Apoorva, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
My name is Pat. I'm from Bernardsville, New Jersey, though I do not teach there. The district in which I teach has decided to separate students into two separate cohorts, a Monday-Tuesday cohort and a Thursday-Friday cohort. Wednesday, all students will be taught virtually. When I teach one cohort, the other cohort will be watching and being taught virtually. My biggest concern is that it's going to have to, by needs, socially distance me from all of my neighbors and my family, especially my 93-year-old mother, because I want to limit access to anyone who might contract COVID from me or from my students.
Hi, this is Chris from Martinez, California. My wife is actually a school teacher, and her district has decided to stay with online learning for the fall. And we shall see what goes from there. I'm sure the decision comes from a lack of a plan to do something safe for all parties concerned.
We're continuing our look at potential school reopenings this fall. And as we just heard, plans look drastically different from state to state and district to district. So we reached out to teachers on this, and we heard from two whose families were directly affected by COVID-19. But their opinions on resuming in-person learning for the fall are very different.
My name is Joewiki Floyd. I am from and live in North, New Jersey. I am an English teacher for North Board of Education. During the regular school year, I teach at Weequahic High School, and during the summer months, I teach at Science Park High School. COVID-19 has impacted all of our lives. I lost my husband. I have students who have lost fathers and mothers and grandparents who were raising them and siblings. And so we've been hit really hard in our district. At the moment, I'm definitely comfortable with that in-person learning because of my personality. I need it. However, I am concerned because I also have four children, two who are school age, one actually just graduated, but my two school age children and myself, we need that person-to-person, in-person. We need that contact. And so I just feel as though if we properly prepare and we use our PPE correctly, that we will definitely be safe. Thinking about my husband's death during this pandemic, it's not a part of my concern of us returning. He had a lot of underlying health conditions. Everyone else in the family, we're pretty much healthy. My concern when I think about it is I don't want to bring my family. I don't want to bring anything back to my family. However, being in this house with my children, my biggest worry is that they lose their social etiquette. So I want them around other children. I'm really hoping that adults really take the proper protocols to, you know, ensure the safety of everyone, because I know if I go back into the classroom, I will. If I had it my way, and if I was, you know, if my husband was still here, and I would definitely stay in the house. Let me just make that clear. I would opt out for my children to go back to school, because I always wanted to homeschool them, and I would teach from home as well. However, I don't have that luxury to do so. It's like, it's that saying, you know, we have to choose the least of the demons. So I'd rather go out in the world than stay in the house and feel like we're regressing.
In Detroit, Michigan, Marietta Elliott is feeling more skeptical about going back for in-person teaching.
I am a special education teacher for Detroit Public Schools Community District. I'm also a parent of four DPSCD students. My four daughters attend schools in our district. I have a lot of concerns. You know, first of all, I'm in Detroit, which is an epicenter. It's just, we've had so many cases of death from COVID-19. In my building in particular, one of our staff members died from it, unfortunately. And we've had several staff members to be impacted and have the virus, including myself. In my school also, we've had several students to be impacted by it, where they've lost grandparents and parents. So my concerns going into the fall, I don't want our students as well as my children to be part of an experiment to see if it's possibly okay for them to go. I would much prefer us to start with a virtual platform if that's the safest thing, rather than to throw us out there too soon and then we have to be pulled, you know, out of school due to deaths or, you know, a lot of sickness just running rampant in our district. My kids are absolutely not going back. I don't feel comfortable sending them. You know, financially for myself, I definitely have some concerns and some hesitations with that. So it's a conversation my husband and I are having. We're trying to plan for the potential of if I don't feel safe, to see if we can, you know, financially stay afloat. But I definitely have concerns and hesitations about going in. I can't say emphatically what I'm going to do, but I can say definitively that my children will not be participating in face-to-face learning in the fall. What's being presented in the media is that teachers may not want to go back, but we absolutely want to go back. We love our students just like we love our children. Sometimes, you know, we're put in positions where we feel like we're putting our students before our own children. So it's not that we don't want to be back in the classroom, but our focus is always on our students, always on our children, and we want to just make sure that they are the safest possible at all times. That's all. We just want to ensure that. I mean, it's just shocking to read about teachers preparing wheels to go back to work. That's something unheard of. A teacher having to prepare to die, you know, and it's over, you know, doing something that we love to do. So I just really want to put that out there. It is really weighing heavy on all the educators. We want to be in school. That's something we really want to do. But the safety of our students and our children, that's just first. It's going to come first.
That was Marietta Elliott, who teaches students with disabilities in Detroit, Michigan, and Joicki Floyd, who teaches English in Newark, New Jersey. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be hearing from more teachers on their district's plans for the fall. And we'd also love for you to keep sharing your thoughts with us. If you're a parent or a teacher or work at a school, tell us how you're feeling about your school's plans for the fall. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. As COVID-19 rages across the world, Puerto Rico officials are walking back the steps the island had taken toward reopening, including issuing a new travel advisory that postpones inbound tourism. So far, there have been nearly 12,500 cases of the virus on the island, and at least 180 people have died. Danica Cotto is a correspondent for the Associated Press covering the Caribbean, and she joins us now from San Juan. Danica, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what does the new travel advisory actually do? It's a little confusing on first read, or second read even.
It is. overall, the tourists were never banned from visiting the island. You know, the governor has tried to limit flights from hotspots, and her most recent request targeted flights out of Texas and out of Florida. But in the end, she needs approval from the FAA to do any of that. So earlier this year, the government said they're preparing, you know, to reopen for tourism. And then they just rolled that back last Thursday when the governor announced, no, you know, we're pushing that back. We've seen a spike in cases. Basically, please stay home. Don't come to Puerto Rico. You know, there's fragile healthcare system as it is. And there's been a lot of videos and pictures posted on social media showing certain tourists flaunting, you know, the governor's executive order, refusing to wear face masks or going to the beach when currently that's prohibited unless you're exercising on the beach.
And Danica, I mean, I was just going to say, can you tell us a little bit more about the tension that we're hearing between the tourists who have already come to the island and the Puerto Ricans on the island right now? It feels like there was a confluence of a couple of things, cheap tickets potentially to get to the island, and more. Like, where are those tensions rising?
They are rising. There's a lot of outrage in Puerto Rico, and it's growing. You know, you have to remember that people here spent nearly 3 months on lockdown. You know, Puerto Rico had one of the longest lockdowns in a U.S. jurisdiction that began in mid-March. People, you know, responded to that executive order, and now they're saying, well, we worked so hard, we stayed indoors, we made a lot of sacrifices, only to have people from possibly states, you know, including Florida, Texas, and elsewhere that have a high number of cases. They're coming to the island. They're not wearing their masks. And so there's a lot of anger, you know, about this, a lot of frustration, because there's only so much, you know, people on the island can do. And experts have noted this, too. They said part of the problem is that the government keeps closing businesses, but what they should be targeting is controlling the number of visitors and making sure that they do adhere to the executive order. Some of the new measures have dissuaded tourists to the island. These include requiring proof of a negative molecular test 72 hours prior, that has to be taken 72 hours prior to travel. And officials note that daily arrivals have dropped from 7,000 to 5,000 in recent days. So there is, you know, the measures are having some effect, but as you mentioned, you know, there's very cheap tickets, and there's a sense that, you know, anything kind of goes in Puerto Rico, which is not the case. So there is a lot of outrage, you know, against people who sort of flaunt the orders that are in place to curb coronavirus cases.
Danica, Wanda Vasquez is the current governor of Puerto Rico. How do Puerto Ricans feel about her leadership so far through the crisis?
Well, I'd say it's changed. Back in March, she was highly praised by many, not only experts, but Puerto Ricans, for implementing an early lockdown that, you know, health experts say did have a positive effect. But since then, people and again, experts as well, believe that she has mishandled the pandemic. You know, she about a month ago, she reopened bars, churches, theaters, gyms, beaches, and this, contrary to recommendations from a government task force that was appointed early on in the pandemic, saying, you know, these openings are coming too soon. We don't yet have a good idea of what's going on the island, given at the time that not so many tests were being done and that officials didn't really have an idea of what the real-time situation was. So she's received a lot of criticism for that. Then last week, she announced major rollbacks. You know, again, certain businesses were closed. Beaches went back to being available only to those doing exercise.
Danica, let me ask you a question, though. I mean, in terms of the treatment the two groups we're thinking about here are tourists and Puerto Ricans who live on the island. Are tourists allowed to go to the beach?
Well, nobody's allowed to go to the beach, but there have been pictures on social media of tourists sitting on the beach in, you know, like the popular district, tourist district of Condado, you know, people sitting on the beach, which is not allowed. So that also is creating a lot of outrage against what some people feel is different treatment. You know, there are some regulations that are being more followed in terms of, you know, like banning visits to the historic part of Puerto Rico's capital, which is known as Old San Juan. Nobody except people who live in the popular nearby islands of Vieques and Culebra can take ferries. No alcohol can be sold on Sunday. So there are certain measures, regulations that are being enforced, but people feel that tourists are kind of given, more of a leeway in terms of the mandatory use of masks and what spaces can be used for entertainment.
Danica, what has the federal government response been so far? I mean, we saw a preview of that response after Hurricane Maria under President Trump, at least. Are we seeing similar attitudes toward the island and its COVID-19 pandemic?
When it comes to the FAA specifically, there's been no response to requests to limit flights from hotspots. And experts say that would be a big help in controlling, you know, the number of cases on the island. However, Puerto Rico has received or has been allocated at least $14 billion in federal funds. And of these, $3.45 billion has been for the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. Again, that has not been carried out well on the island. There's been numerous reports of people sleeping in their cars overnight, trying to be first in line to obtain this type of assistance, people standing in line all day. Again, concerns, you know, of hundreds of people standing in line and not respecting, you know, the social distancing measures. So while the money has been allocated, many Puerto Ricans feel it hasn't been properly used or it hasn't been really given to those who need it the most. You know, you still have tens of thousands of people awaiting assistance. And these are people who have already been through Hurricane Maria, have been through the earthquakes. You know, they were starting from scratch back then, and they still haven't, they're still not at the place where they were before the hurricane. So there's still concerns over the help that's not getting to people. But again, you know, the federal government is worried about how the money is being handled, given the history of corruption and mismanagement in Puerto Rico's government.
Danica Cotto is a correspondent for the AP covering the Caribbean. Danica, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And you can hear all of our coverage on Puerto Rico at thetakeaway.org/Puerto Rico.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We continue our look at the life and legacy of Congressman John Lewis, who died Friday at the age of 80, the same day the world lost another civil rights leader, Reverend C.T. Vivian. Congressman Lewis was known for many things in his long career. He was a civil rights legend who led the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he spoke at the historic March on Washington in 1963. He was a member of Congress who represented Georgia's 5th Congressional District for more than 3 decades and fought for voting rights until the very end. But Congressman Lewis also had a deeply creative side. Just a few years ago, he co-authored an award-winning autobiographical graphic novel trilogy called March, which chronicled America's struggle for civil rights. And here he is speaking on The Takeaway in 2016.
Andrew Iden suggested to me that I should write a comic book. I was reluctant, but he convinced me, and I finally said, yes, if you would do it with me. And it reminded me that when I was about 17 and a half, almost 18, I guess, that I read a comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story that told the story of the Montgomery bus boycott. And this little comic book inspired me and many other young people to get involved in the civil rights movement.
I'm joined now by Andrew Iden, the co-author of the March Trilogy with Congressman Lewis and graphic novelist Nate Powell. Andrew also served as digital director and policy advisor to Congressman Lewis. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you so much for having me.
How did the March graphic novel trilogy come together? We heard a little bit from Congressman Lewis at the top, but tell us when you got involved.
Yeah, first, I can't hear his voice without tearing up a little bit, so I'm sorry if I'm a little groggy, but, it was the summer of 2008. I was working on the congressman's reelection campaign, and we were out And I was hearing the stories of his life from the perspective of being a young person in the movement for the first time. I mean, I'd grown up in his district. He'd been my congressman since I was 3 years old. But I'd never heard those stories until I was sitting with him and listening at his knee, just like so many other young people. And when it came down to the end of that campaign, folks started making fun of me for saying I was going to a comic book convention after the campaign was over. And the congressman said, "Don't laugh. There was a comic book during the movement." And it was incredibly influential. And that sort of set us on our path. That comic book became our guide, as you heard him say. And then we started working. I mean, and we joked. We were like, "Well, we have to work at night because we have day jobs," which I thought was so funny for him to refer to being a member of Congress as his day job. But that's what we did. We would stay up so late at night. I would interview him. I would ask him questions. Sometimes he would fall asleep. Sometimes I would fall asleep. Sometimes you'd just hear a little snore on the other end of the line. And then you'd be like, "Congressman, wake up." And he'd be like, "I'm not sleeping. I'm just resting my eyes." And, you know, we worked for over 2 years before we even found a publisher because everybody thought we were nuts. And then we worked in the end for 5 years before we even put out a single volume. But, you know, it would be one of those things where we would sort of sneak each other looks or conversations on an elevator when no one was around about, "Hey, you know that story or that picture I just saw? We should make sure that's in the book." And we did that. We did that for almost a decade. And then
the work was fruitful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's important to understand the context of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story relative to the comic. It wasn't just that we followed how they made the comic. It was that we followed Dr. King and Jim Lawson's example with how they distributed the comic and how they got their message out through the comic. Jim Lawson, who was also Congressman Lewis's mentor in Nashville, he embarked on what they called a reconciliation tour, which was basically a series of nonviolent workshops that he gave throughout the South and as far north as Oklahoma. And those helped create the climate and the environment in the early days for the sit-in movement. And so he would go, he would give the nonviolence workshop, and then he would hand out the comic book afterwards so that the young people had something to read and also to take with them and pass on and learn and study. And so that's what we did. I mean, we spent maybe 50 to 75 days a year on the road doing events, talking to kids. We went to visit incarcerated youth in places like Washington and Cook County in Chicago and around the country. We would go and speak at the American Library Association. We would go and speak at Comic-Con. I mean, he cosplayed as himself. He was trying to do everything he could to dramatize this conflict so that he could teach this generation about nonviolence and about their power. And I think as he looked around at what was happening right now, I think he saw that it worked. That he did it, that he created the climate and the environment for young people to stand up and speak out as he'd been trying to urge them to do for so many years. And that was him embracing these outside of the box ideas, these ideas that folks didn't fully understand at the time, that because they were ahead of their time, and using them to push America forward.
And ultimately, March, Book 3, which was the third installment of the trilogy, became the first graphic novel, Andrew, as you know, to win the National Book Award for Young People's Literature in 2016. I'm going to play some of Congressman Lewis's speech that night.
And I remember in 1956, when I was 16 years old, with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins, going down to the public library, trying to get library cards. And we were told that the library was for whites only and not for colors. And to come here and receive this award, this honor for this, it's too much. Thank you.
Andrew, we've got about a minute left in this segment. What do you recall from that night?
I remember a lot of tears. We knew we had to be there. It was right after the election, and we were really struggling because of what had happened. And we knew we had to be there. And so we went, we took the train up, and we get there that night, and we put on our tuxes, and we're sitting at the table. And I remember holding hands because we didn't want to believe it would happen until it happened. And then when it did, and Catherine Patterson, who the author, gave us the award, we were crying and we hugged. And I remember the congressman said, if you never do another thing, you've done enough.
We're now joined by Dr. Sheena Howard, Associate Professor of Communications at Rider University and author of Black Comics, Politics of Race and Representation. Sheena, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So comics, Sheena, and graphic novels have historically, not surprisingly, been a medium dominated by white men. How has that changed in recent years?
Well, I think around, 2013, when the first March book actually came out, there was, there was a shift. There was a real convergence in the comics world where a lot of different African-Americans in different spaces and in different parts of the community were coming together to write comics and graphic novels. And also, it really began to take off in academe, and comic scholarship began to be taken seriously. So in the last 10 years, there's been great interest and convergence with the medium.
Andrew, you co-authored March with Congressman Lewis, as we talked about in the previous segment. And I'm wondering, in terms of nonfiction, what is it that graphic novels can do that other mediums don't?
It's a total shift from the perspective of the viewer, right? I mean, when you're talking about prose, you're not showing, you're telling. But when you're in a graphic novel, you're showing. But when you compare that to a documentary, you go from the third person to the first person. So as a congressman would say, it's like you're there. It's like you're in the moment. And it allows this more fully immersive experience for the reader that creates a greater depth of understanding. But it also takes a different kind of scholarship to write nonfiction graphic novels, which I think is something we're just starting to fully understand, that you have to get a different kind of detail than you do if you write a prose book or you do a documentary.
Sheena, let's dig into that a little bit, because you've actually studied comics and graphic storytelling, particularly with Black creatives. Was there anything in the March trilogy that stood out to you in the way that it used that medium?
I mean, for me, March really highlighted, one, of course, John Lewis's commitment to nonviolence and the power of it. But also, I think one of the things the book showed is white violence. And I think white violence is not something in the media that we focus on or gets enough attention. And we really get to see through the visuals and the writing of this particular trilogy how one can be committed to nonviolence, but also the historical white violence that has been perpetuated and continues to happen in this country.
And Sheena, we're seeing nonfiction graphic novels like Mouse and the March trilogy being used in the classroom. How can those be most effectively used? How graphic novels over traditional textbooks, even? Because we know that there have been, mm-hmm. we had a segment recently about just how much our textbooks have failed us historically.
Right. So there's a lot of great literature and research that shows that graphic novels and comics have been teaching kids to read. It's a very effective medium in bringing young kids in to help them to learn to read. There are a number of kids that I meet that say, I learned to read reading comics and graphic novels because it brings them in a different way. Kids might not intuitively be interested in an autobiography or a biography that's a historical account of something. But when you add those visuals, it hooks them in. And they're still getting the same information, but they're getting it in a much more interactive and engaging way. And I think that's why it's been so well-received, particularly at the high school level and the grade school level.
Andrew, you talked a lot about that in the previous segment, just about how Congressman Lewis wanted this taught across the schools. He did everything he could. I'm wondering how the March trilogy broke ground for others in the graphic novel and comics industry.
I think March has opened the door to a whole new generation of creators and stories. Right now, you're seeing graphic novels be published that would have never been published before. So whether it's David Walker with his autobiography of Frederick Douglass, or his Black Panther graphic novels, or the Black Panther Party graphic novel, or it's folks like Nick Susannis who are looking at these in-depth studies of how you use sequential narrative to tell stories with a greater information load. On all sides of the spectrum, graphic novels have expanded, and even on a dollar-to-dollar sense, year over year, the industry just keeps getting bigger and bigger. But these were not comics that were being published before March. It wasn't until the largely white publishing industry saw that there was money to be made. This isn't necessarily just a moral stand, but I think what's so beautiful is that you have creators who are finally doing their dream projects, the stories that have lived in their hearts, but only now can finally come to the page that we're seeing in bookstores.
Sheena, to that point, we know it is about the money, but also are you seeing more opportunities, both on in terms of those who are able to create, to Andrew's point, but also is this opening doors for new audiences to have these types of stories told to a broader audience?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just seeing so much convergence, again, particularly since 2013, 2014, where people in different industries are actually engaging with comics. And it just makes the potential for the medium so much more vast going forward. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates writes Black Panther, coming from like a journalist background. Andrew mentioned David Walker now doing, you know, this graphic novel on Frederick Douglass. Even these African-American creators and artists who may have been writing, you know, fiction in the past are now feeling and having license to now write nonfiction and feel comfortable doing that, and also being supported by publishers. And some very good publishers out there that have a specific focus on publishing historical accounts of graphic novels.
I'd love to. I mean, I'm honestly not as well versed in the world of graphic novels. So this is really, I mean, one of the things that struck me about March was just how gorgeous it was to look at. Andrew, the visuals in this graphic novel were stunning.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to give all the credit to Nate Powell. Nate Powell is one of the finest graphic novelists of his generation. And I think that was something that the congressman and I often talked about, which is that each of us had a very important role to play, and the graphic novel wouldn't have been possible, not the success it had, without all three of us bringing every bit of talent that we had to the books. And Nate's art, you know, it's already hung in museums that had never had graphic novel art on the wall before, and I think it's just the beginning. And so I think that's another piece that we have to talk about, which is how do we mentor and shepherd the careers of young comic artists, because the industry is very difficult and they make very little money. And unless they have a hit like March, it's very difficult to survive.
We've got less than a minute left, Andrew, but should we expect more of the March series in the future?
You know, I don't have dates or specifics or anything like that, but the congressman and I were working on a sequel to March called Run, because first you march and then you run. And we're hoping to have some news about that soon.
Well, we'll be paying attention. Andrew Iden is the co-author of the March Trilogy with Congressman John Lewis, and Dr. Sheena Howard is Associate Professor of Communications at Rider University and author of Black Comics, Politics of Race and Representation. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for continuing to listen to us. And please keep calling in. We love hearing from our listeners. So give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you tomorrow.